What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
1-833-288-EWTN.
I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
1-833-288-3986.
What's stopping you?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
What's stopping you? This is Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Hey everybody, welcome again to Call to Communion on this Tuesday afternoon here on EWTN. It is the program for our non-Catholic brothers and sisters. Is that you? Scanning up and down the dial and you hear this program on a Catholic network and you go, well, I'm not Catholic, but I've got this question about the Catholic faith that I've always wondered about. Why do you guys fill in the blank? Hey, if that's you, give us a call. We can fill in that blank for you. 833-288-EWTN is our phone number, 833-288-3986. Outside North America, please dial 1 and then 205-271-2985. You can also text the letters EWTN to 58177. Wait for our response, and then when you get that response, type in your first name and your brief question. Message and data rates may apply. You can also send us an email. We've got one in a moment here from Malta. ctc@ewtn.com is the address, ctc@ewtn.com. All right, and we have Pedro Quiles as our producer, Matt Kabinski handling the phones. I'm Tom Price, along with Dr. David Anders.
Tom, how are you today?
I'm well. How are you, sir?
I'm doing decent. Thank you.
Interesting question here. This is from Marcus in Malta. Dear Dr. Anders, would you not say that the Ethiopian church is an ancient body? King Solomon and the Queen of Sheba had a son, Meneliek, or David, I think it's David I.L., a continuation of the Davidic line up to Haile Selassie. Please elaborate, and that's from Marcus in Malta.
Yeah, thanks. I really appreciate it. So the Ge'ez Rite, the G-E apostrophe E-Z, is one of the two Alexandrian rites that the church recognizes, and there are churches of that rite that are in union with the Holy Father, the Pope of Rome, that are fully Catholic churches. And then there are those that are not in union with Rome that are in union with Alexandria. And they refer to themselves as the Oriental Orthodox Church. They're a branch of Eastern Orthodoxy. They're not in union with the Constantinopolitan churches. So the Byzantines, the Russians, the Slavs, they have a different system than those guys.
Okay.
But absolutely, they're ancient, and they have apostolic succession, and we recognize that. The church recognizes that. So, go Ethiopia. That's all I have to say. Many people are unaware also of the Eritrean rite and Eritrean church. Mm-hmm. There's also an Eritrean Catholic church in union with the Pope. And I was at a USCCB meeting probably about 8 years ago in Orlando, Florida, and I had lunch with a guy who was an Eritrean rite Catholic. And the other folks at the table were all North Americans, and we were various races, but all Roman Rite. We were having a discussion about racism and minorities in the church, and he looked up and he said, "I'm an Eritrean Rite Catholic living in the United States. I am a minority wherever I go in the world," But great guy, an interesting conversation nonetheless.
Very cool. All right, there you go, and thank you, Marcus in Malta, for your email. Here's one now from Bob in Austin. Tom and Dr. Anders, hope today has been treating you well. Can you please, with an eye toward illuminating them all, compare and contrast Old Testament typology, New Testament typology, C.S. Lewis's use of Christian allegory in the Chronicles of Narnia, and J.R.R. Tolkien's self-described inclusion of Catholic applicability in The Lord of the Rings. Specific examples would be most appreciated. Again, that's from Bob in Austin.
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate it. So there are obviously similarities between these things, but there are big differences. So typology is when you have a referent in the Old Testament that evokes something in the New.
Okay.
And New Testament writers explain their own theological position in light of this Old Testament analog. And so an example would be when Paul talks about, you know, that there's a rock that followed the Israelites in the desert, and that rock is Christ. We're meant to see the rock in the desert as a type to which Christ is the antitype, the fulfillment. Another one would be something like, the Old Testament ritual of the showbread. You know, they had to have a freshly baked loaf that would be put out, or the bread of the presence. It's not hard to get evocations of the Eucharist out of that. And so that's what typology is. Now, the New Testament also has typologies. That is to say, there are images or episodes that evoke some further development in Catholic doctrine. An example would be the woman clothed with the sun in Revelation chapter 12, who within context seems to be referring to the church, that is the mother of all those that believe in Christ. But because the imagery is so specific about this being the woman who gives birth to the child who will rule the nation with the rod of iron, that's a reference to the Messianic Psalm 2, it's not a stretch that the Catholic Church has also interpreted that as the Blessed Virgin Mary. So that would be a kind of an example of New Testament typology.
Okay.
None of that is what is going on in the Chronicles of Narnia. And C.S. Lewis always resisted the interpretation of his works that he was writing a kind of allegory. Allegory, strictly speaking, from a literary point of view, is when you say, you know, I'm going to write this thing, and this thing stands for that thing. And so, you know, a good example in English literature would be something like Pilgrim's Progress, where there's a narrative, but the narrative is clearly meant to indicate, something to contemporary English society.
Okay.
Or Spenser's The Faerie Queen, that kind of thing. And that's, Lewis says, that's not what he was doing. What he did instead was an imaginative exercise of saying, if there were a world like Narnia,
uh-huh,
and God sent his son to redeem that world, what would redemption look like in that context?
Okay.
And so it's clearly meant to evoke Christ, but not by way of an allegory. And I have now run out of time to talk about Tolkien, but I suppose we could come back to him after the break if you want to.
We could do that. Yeah, we could wrap that up. We'll also talk with Justin in Silver Spring, Maryland. Lines open for you as well, 833-288-EWTN. If you have a question for Dr. David Andrews, 833-288-3986 for Call to Communion. It's Call to Communion with Dr. David Andrews on this Tuesday afternoon. Very glad to have you along with us. Our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. If you have a question for David, 833-288-3986. Before we go to those phones, we're going to wrap this up here with Bob in Austin, who was comparing and contrasting of Old Testament and New Testament typology, also C.S. Lewis's use of Christian allegory in Narnia, and Tolkien's self-described inclusion of Catholic applicability in The Lord of the Rings. Now, we tackled the first three, but what about Lord of the Rings?
Yeah, well, I absolutely love Lord of the Rings. I mean, everybody, well, not everybody, but all the right sort of people love Lord of the Rings, you know. I mentioned in the last segment that Lewis says he was not writing Christian allegory, and he had a pretty strict definition from, as a literature professor, of what constituted allegory, and that was not it. That's even more true of J.R. Tolkien, that Tolkien really wanted, he put a lot of effort into world building, you know, which is a term fantasy and science fiction writers use to describe the verisimilitude of the fantasy worlds that they create. And so he wanted a world that functioned according to its own internal logic, rules, and history. And of course, he spent a lot of time working out the background histories and that sort of thing. But it was a moral universe. The world of Middle-earth was a moral universe that makes a lot of sense to a Catholic sensibility. So the kinds of struggles the characters go through, the kinds of things that transform them, the nature of the transformations that they undergo, the kind of temptations that they face, and some of the sort of quasi-sacramental elements of the world and its magic— all evoke for a Catholic reader resonances, you know, points of commonality with a Catholic view of the world. Again, I don't think there's any strict allegory there, but it's a fantasy work that's clearly written by a Catholic author.
Oh, very good. And by the way, you do know who invented the phrase allegory, right?
The same guy who invented the internet?
Al Gore.
Right, exactly.
There you go. By the way, if you haven't seen our EWTN On Demand platform, it is fantastic. It features 50 new podcasts each and every week, as well as an ever-expanding library of audio and video content for Catholics who want to learn more about their faith simply by using their mobile device, computer, or TV. Your favorite EWTN programs are available 24/7. Visit EWTN.com. Click On Demand. And by the way, I just picked up my phone, clicked on my EWTN app, and sure enough, there it is, right at the top, On Demand. So do check that out. If you're ready now, let's go to the phones at 833-288-EWTN, beginning with Justin. Justin's in Silver Spring, Maryland, listening on the Great Guadalupe Radio, AM 1160. Hello, Justin. What's on your mind today, sir?
Oh, yeah. I'd like to know if you could tell me about getting people to see things in themselves that typically they wouldn't want to see. You have a phone number or a book or something?
Yeah, what a fantastic question. What a fantastic question. And I'd like to get around to answering it, but if I could, let me go a little bit long on this question. Because just recently I put the question to myself. I do this sort of thing. Like I try to work out answers so that when they come out on the radio, there I am ready for it. And I was asking myself the question, okay, Anders, to the extent that you've made any moral progress in life, and I got a long way to go, buddy, but let me tell you, I think I'm better than I was when I was 20, okay? To the extent that I've made any moral progress in life, how can I account for that? What do I attribute it to? And I, in my own case, I think there's a couple things that have helped me morally. One is having good moral exemplars, that there are people in my life that I look up to, that I admire, and, you know, it's kind of like when I grow up, I want to be like that guy, you know? And that's incredibly important. But number two, and this is absolutely essential. Without this, I don't think you make moral progress at all. And that is coming to deeply appreciate the ways in which I'm not like this person that I want to emulate. And, you know, it's quite possible to have a purely abstract awareness of the fact that I'm a sinner. You know, I can go to Mass, I can say the Confiteor, you know, I confess to Almighty God that I'm a sinner in thought, word, and deed, etc., etc. Have mercy on me, beat my breast, etc. You can do all that and yet be utterly ignorant of your specific faults. I you know, when I wrote my doctoral dissertation on Calvin, John Calvin, one of the things that struck me is he had a really, really profound, and this is not a compliment necessarily, but he had a very rigorous doctrine of sin. But I began to realize after several years of diving into his works, almost no awareness of personal sin. You know, he would make a general confession of like, you know, oh, woe is me, I'm a sinner.
Uh-huh.
But I never found the guy to ever apologize or to backtrack or to say I was wrong. Quite the contrary. He was very sure of his moral positions and his dogmatic positions, and was always the other person who was wrong.
Okay.
Which made me think he really had blinders on that area of his life. And then the final thing would be, you know, what are the tools that you use to work on the realizations you've had of your own failings? Now, I really think, so how do you come to realize that you're making mistakes? I think the best teacher is reality. When what you're doing is not working and you find yourself sort of beating your head against the wall of reality. Now, there are people who can beat their head against the wall of reality for their entire life and die angry and alone and utterly convinced to the end that it's the other guy's fault. What accounts for that versus the person who finally wakes up and goes, you know, something's not working here and I got to change. I don't know. It's a mystery. Call it grace, right? But it's at some point, you know, in the world of addiction therapy, they'd call it hitting bottom. When you reach okay. a point where you realize, you know, it's no longer worth it to me to be right. I'm hurting too bad to worry about being right. I'm now ready to be taught. You know, one of my children was a fairly recalcitrant young man, and then he got to early adulthood and came to me one day and said, "Okay, Dad, I am now ready for you to instruct me.
Wow.
Tell me what to do." Like, wasn't there 5 years ago, but I've gotten there because reality started to knock, you know, at his door. So that's clearly an element. But there are other things that I think are very helpful. Other than just the suffering imposed by our own hard-headedness, if I can come to understand that docility to the truth is a precondition for wisdom. Like, you can't be wise or rational unless you're willing to self-correct. And to also understand the truth that even if you're a genius, your perspective is limited to your point of view and your experience. That there is someone else in the world who knows more about something than you do. And that you need to know what they have to say. And enter into dialogue with other people with a determination to be taught by them. And in particular about yourself. You know, I recently read a secular book on psychotherapy, and I walked away with the conviction that 90% of the benefit of psychotherapy, if there is any, is in getting people to see things about themselves that they wouldn't otherwise see. But the system, the mechanism of psychotherapy exists because people have a really hard time doing that without someone else reflecting it back to them.
Mm.
So, you know, a really good accountability group of the right kind. You know, there's something like this built into Benedictine monasticism because they have these chapter meetings where they get together and basically reveal their faults to one another. And this isn't a confession of sin. This is like an accusation of sin. Like, okay, bud, here's where you need to shape up this week.
Wow.
And you got to learn the humility to sit there and take that and take it to heart. So you need a system. You need a practice, a procedure of that in your life. If you have the right kind of marriage, that can do it for you real quick. Although, you know, my father once called me aside and he said, "David, let me tell you something." I said, "What's that, Dad?" He said, "They're allowed to criticize us. We're not allowed to criticize them." You know, that's how this goes, Anders, you know. But let me tell you something. If I wanted to know, my wife would let me know real fast what my faults were, okay? So your kids will too. Sometimes not directly, but indirectly, right? And love helps because if you really care about them and you wake up one day and realize, you know, I'm losing them, and all my pontificating about the right thing to do is falling on deaf ears. My son mm-hmm. said to me one time, "Daddy, you're right about everything and nobody cares." Right? Then eventually you're like, you know, I need to stop caring about being right and I need to start caring about, am I being effective and I'm not being effective. Right?
Caring about caring.
Caring about caring, exactly. You know, the discipline, the practice, the institution of spiritual direction in the Catholic Church is meant to get at this. And the idea behind spiritual direction is that we're not good judges of our own prayer lives. St. John of the Cross once said that many people think they pray well and they pray quite badly. Some people think they pray badly but actually pray quite well. And we really can't see that in our own case. You know, there's a condition, there's a psychiatric condition called, I think it's called anagnosia, I think it's what it's called. And it is a diagnosable condition of the inability to know that you're sick. So when a person has some underlying medical condition and they can't see that they have it, and there's some evidence that it may be actually caused by lesions in the brain, so it's not just psychological. But that lack of insight into one's own illness is itself a really devastating medical condition. But there's an, if I'm saying it right, anagnosia, there's an anagnosia of the spiritual life, a kind of habitual inability to see where I'm at fault. You know, the opposite virtue is docility, or teachableness. Spiritual direction is meant to open that up. But, you know, I've known cases of spiritual direction or discipleship where someone asks another, "Would you disciple me?" "Oh, yeah, sure, I'll disciple you." "Okay, meeting number one, here's what you need to work on." "Are you saying I don't have that virtue? What are you talking about? I've got that in spades, you know." "No, sorry, that's not going to work. You know, you got to be open to, you got to be docile to instruction."
Yep.
So, you know, if you want a resource, you know, there is a literature on spiritual direction in the Catholic Church. Father Charles Dubé, you know, has a book on spiritual direction. Dan Burke has books on spiritual direction that talk about the goals and methods and practices. There's a you know, pretty significant research in and body of literature in psychotherapy and counseling that is meant to help uncover the kind of pathology people have in their thinking. There's a cognitive science of human cognition that unveils the kind of built-in cognitive biases that scientists have come and psychologists have come to recognize characterize human error. The book Thinking Fast and Slow by Tversky and I'll think of the other guy's name in a minute, you know, Nobel Prize winning scientists that just document hundreds of ways and people are kind of habitually blind to their own irrationalities. That's a huge literature.
Okay.
And all of this stuff comes into play. And in fact, I mean, going as far back as the Platonic dialogues, I mean, the whole Socratic method, the Socratic Olynkos, was about helping people to see the ways in which they failed to see. Right. And the Socratic dialectic and the various spiritual practices advocated therein were meant to be a kind of cure. And it's more complex than simply laying out a thesis that you articulate and argue. That's why Plato uses dialectic and metaphor and myth and all these different genres to try to break through the logjam of a merely deductive but narrow-minded logic. So, and of course, the Catholic Church comes to incorporate all that into its own spirituality. The work of the French philosopher Pierre Hadot, his book What is Ancient Philosophy, has a magnificent chapter on Christian spiritual traditions as they incorporate this kind of behavioral and cognitive therapy that was born out of Hellenistic philosophy. And I'm really geeking out now. I should stop.
Justin, thanks so much for your call. Hope that's helpful for you. Quite a few great resources there. Hey, that opens up a line for you right now at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Call to communion on this Tuesday afternoon here on EWTN. In a few minutes, we're going to get to Bernadette in Independence, Missouri. But first, this question from Meg in Doylestown, PA, something you may not have thought about. Dr. Anders, how do Catholic churches get their names?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, bishops and priests, probably with sometimes input from the laity, pick them. And there is no rhyme or reason as to why. I mean, there could be some local reason. Some Catholic has sought the intercession of a particular saint for a particular intention, and you know they receive an answer to their prayer. That devotion might become popular. There may be some thematic reason in the bishop's ministry that would evoke that. I mean, you know, my own diocese has a cathedral named for St. Paul, and I'm not sure what the origin of that identification was, but we're a mission diocese, and he was the church's great missionary, it's got to be a saint.
Yeah.
Typically, I mean, not always. Sometimes we have churches that are named for things like the Sacred Heart.
But sure, sure.
It's usually a saint, and it's a saint that someone involved in the foundation of that particular parish has a devotion to.
I know that here in Birmingham, there was a church years ago, St. Mark the Evangelist. That church was closed down for whatever reason. And then some years later, a new church was built, and of course, they grabbed that name. St. Mark's.
St. Mark's 2.0.
How about that? Yeah. There you go. And thanks so much for your question, Meg in Doylestown, PA. And as promised, in a moment, we'll be talking with Bernadette in Independence, Missouri. Lines are open for you as well, 833-288-EWTN, if you have a question for Dr. David Anders. 833-288-3986. Call to communion here on this Tuesday afternoon on EWTN. Stay with us. It's called a communion here on EWTN. If you've got a question for Dr. David Anders, or if you'd like to explain to us what is stopping you from becoming a Catholic, whatever, give us a call, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. 888-288-3986. Congratulations going out to our great EWTN radio partner, and that would be Evangelist Radio, serving Summersville, West Virginia. They are now celebrating 14 years with EWTN. Congratulations to you, Louise and Jeff Molnar, and the great team there at WSJE from your friends here at EWTN. All right, back to the phones now at 833-288-EWTN. As promised, Bernadette in Independence, Missouri, listening on the great Catholic Radio Network. Hello, Bernadette. What's on your mind today?
Hi, Dr. Andrews. I was hoping you could help me with something. My sister, who's going through a divorce, is leaving the Catholic Church, and she has severed all ties with me. I'm not allowed to speak to my nieces and nephews because of my stance on I embrace the church's teaching on homosexuality. And I was wondering if maybe you could suggest some reading material that I could mail to her that explains lovingly why the church's stance is on homosexuality, and hopefully get her to return to the faith.
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate the question. So, of course, there's lots of good reading material on the church's teaching on human sexuality. In my judgment, the absolute wrong approach to take with your sister is to mail her reading material, because I'd say that there is a 0% chance that she will read it, and a greater than 100% chance that if she did read it, it would be in order to find fault in criticism and to take a contrary point of view. And you know, all of the evidence, theological, social, scientific, etc., is that you know, argument typically does not persuade people, and that people accept arguments when those arguments confirm their basic intuitions about the world. And you know, Cardinal Newman, Saint John Henry Newman, wrote a book 150 years ago called An Essay in Aid of a Grammar of Assent. How do you get people to assent to the church's propositions?
Uh-huh.
And this is essentially his thesis, that he said, I want to touch people's hearts, not just, you know, bedazzle them with argument. And much more recently, there's a social psychologist named Jonathan Haidt, who's not a Catholic, who wrote a book, 10 years ago, called The Righteous Mind, subtitle, Why Good People Disagree on Religion and Politics. And he essentially comes to the same conclusion as Cardinal Newman, but backs it up with new, you know, scientific methods of placebo-controlled studies and things like that. And his thesis is that sort of deductive logic almost never persuades anybody of any moral position whatsoever at all. Rather, they go seeking out those positions that confirm their basic intuitions about the world. And those intuitions are formed pre-rationally, right? They're formed because of your embodied, embedded social conditions. The sociologist Peter Berger talked about what he called plausibility structures. And it's, the way people come to view the world and what they take to be a plausible explanation is highly correlated to the social circles that they run in. And much more recently, Samuel Stroop, who's a sociologist at Baylor University, mm-hmm. wrote an article. The title escapes me for the moment, but I'm going to give you the thesis. How do you account for varying degrees of religious orthodoxy, the extent to which people believe what their church teaches? And what he showed scientifically was that there is a straight line correlation between your social embeddedness in a community and the extent to which you believe its dogmatic propositions. So when all of your friends are Orthodox Catholics, you're going to be an Orthodox Catholic. When none of your friends are Orthodox Catholics, there's a very low chance you'll be one.
Hmm.
Right? And so the takeaway from all of that, and so that's, you know, that's that's from Christian and non-Christian sources alike. That's from theologians as well as social scientists, is that the real way to change people's thinking on moral issues starts by winning their trust and befriending them. All right. And this is not a cop out. This is not me, you know, trying to dodge the big issues. This is my realistic embrace of what all of the facts and the evidence show, that the way to change people is to get in there and love and accompany them. And you know, show, no, don't tell is what the old adage is in writing. But it's true in evangelism as well. I remember early on in my formation when I was getting all the arguments right, I had a really sort of heated argument with a fellow on a theological topic. He was not a believer. And I, you know, I knew all the arguments backwards and forwards, buddy. And I just wiped the floor with the guy. I just, you know, I won all over the place. And, you know, what did I expect to happen? Is he going to throw up his hands and say, praise Jesus, and come into the church? What he said instead was quite different. He looked at me and he goes, yeah, but Dave, I don't like Christians.
Ouch.
And I thought, I didn't say it out loud, but I thought, yeah, that's the one thing I neglected, and that's the rub of the whole issue.
Yeah.
And so, you know, my I really think that the proper response to this is to get in there and just love you some gay people really, really hard. Just love the ever-living stew out of them and do it in an undeniable way and be the contradiction to their stereotype of Catholic orthodoxy.
Children of God.
You know, and you know, there are some books that I think you should read on the Catholic Church's position to get your head kind of, make sure you have the theology right. You know, one came out, there was a kind of a big... you know, brouhaha about divorce and marriage and homosexuality a few years ago, and a number of Catholic authors put together a book called, I think it's called Remaining in the Truth of Christ. That's a good one. The Princeton philosopher Robert George has a book called, I think it's called Conjugal Union. I believe that's the title, and it's a defense of the traditional doctrine of marriage. And, you know, there are other good ones out there. The Catechism of the Catholic Church, honestly, is not bad. But and so Catholics ought to read that stuff. So, you know, like St. Peter says, be ready to give an answer when they ask you.
Yeah.
But they're not going to ask if they don't care. And if I'm asked because I think the person just wants to pick a fight, then I don't want to take that bait. I remember one time I was present at an address. Scott Hahn came to Birmingham, Alabama. This was 15 years ago, I think. And I was hadn't been Catholic that long. I've been Catholic 21 years now. But it was, you know, 15, 17 years ago Scott Hahn came to Alabama. And he spoke at a Baptist university. I think he was the first, right? And that was quite an event. And a huge crowd came out to hear him. A lot of Catholics, a lot of Baptists too. And there was a Q&A at the end. And I remember this Baptist girl got up and she made some anti-Catholic remarks and threw out some old canards of, you know, polemics against Catholicism. And I thought they were quite sophomoric. And I thought to myself, okay, here's where Dr. Hahn is going to eviscerate her. He's going to vivisect her with his, you know, profound theological knowledge. This is when we're going to really see the fireworks shine. He's, you know, it's the... this is shooting fish in a barrel for Scott Hahn to take her apart. And I was shocked when he didn't do it.
He didn't take the bait.
He absolutely, and I was like, Scott, my man, you're totally blowing it. You can take this woman apart rhetorically right now. The answers are right in front of your face, and you know them 10 times better than I do. Why aren't you smashing her to theological bits with your superior knowledge? And what he was doing instead was he almost ignored the question and started bidding to her for points of commonality. And I thought, at the time, I thought, oh, gosh, this guy's just, he's a genius. But I thought, how naive can he be, right? Now, looking back on it, I'm like, how naive could I have been?
He wasn't naive at
all. He wasn't naive at all. His approach was the right one. Right?
Yeah.
Because he was there to win friends,
sure,
not to win arguments. And he'll win the argument later. You know, people don't read apologetics because they are totally uninterested in the Catholic faith. Mm-hmm. When you get to the stage of reading Catholic apologetics, you're at the stage of saying, I want to be convinced, now convince me.
Wow.
And you got to get them to that stage of, I want to be convinced because there's a goodness here that I don't understand. Let them see the goodness first.
Is that helpful for you, Bernadette?
Very much. No.
Fantastic. Hey, thank you so much for your call today. It's Call to Communion here on EWTN. Our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-8255. 888-298-3986. Tomorrow morning on Catholic Connection with Teresa Tomeo, she'll be joined by Tom Nash with Catholic Answers, talking about studying Scripture. Also, Jason Gale of Tan Books, talking about the new book, Martyrs of the Eucharist, Stories to Inspire Eucharistic Amazement, by the late Reverend J. Francis Sophie, O.P. Should be a wonderful program tomorrow morning, 9 a.m. Eastern, right here and only here on EWTN Radio. All right, let's go to Jim now in Portland, listening on the great Modern Day Radio. Hello there, Jim. What's on your mind today, sir?
Well, I don't know whether to mention the name of the case or not, but about 20 years ago, there was a stricken woman, and the husband wanted to... I'll level with you. It was a Terry Schiavo case.
Sure, sure.
He wanted her gone, and I mean, he wanted separation. You know, if the church would have bent, give him a divorce, he could remarry in the Catholic Church, they wouldn't have pulled the feeding tubes, and she'd have lived. And I guess to the extent, it was oh so legal, too. You know, both church and state, you know, it was a federal judge that ordered the feeding tubes pulled. You know, if annulment wouldn't have been... you get the drift. I mean, she had to go, and they pull the tubes, and that bothers me. And there's all this absolutism, but it was oh so correct and oh so legal, and that bothers me.
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate the question.
You remember the Terry Schiavo case?
I remember it quite well.
Yeah.
So, you know, my father died of a degenerative disease. He died of Lou Gehrig's disease. And that was very burdensome on the family, really big time, financially, emotionally, psychologically, physically. I mean, he got to the point where he needed 24/7 care because he literally could not lift a finger. He could talk, but many people with Lou Gehrig's lose the ability to speak, you know, fairly early on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so, you know, they're really not contributing anything to the family welfare at all, and their existence is just tremendously burdensome to the people around them. And but none of us would have contemplated for a second the suggestion that we just off the guy to put us out of our misery, right? And I remember my dad, when we were talking about his end-of-life care, he said, well, I really have two criteria. I don't want to kill myself, and I don't want my family to become murderers. And it's not like he was afraid to die. He wasn't afraid to die at all, but he wanted to make sure that everybody behaved morally. And you know, I remember having to take the position myself and articulate it to myself and others. I said, look, even if my father becomes utterly incapable of communicating, his life is a tremendous value to me. And I believe that his existence is valuable in ways that maybe I don't even completely understand. And is worth preserving and honoring, regardless of the consequences and circumstances, you know, to me or to him or you know, whatever. And clearly, I know that if I fell ill, very you know gravely ill, let me flip it around. If my wife fell ill in that way, you know, I took a vow through sickness and in health, for better or for worse, riches. Poverty, as long as we both shall live. Why do you take a vow? You know, I vow to eat all the ice cream I want to eat from now until I die. You don't take that vow. Because you know why? Because you're going to eat all the ice cream you want between now and when you die. Right? You take a vow to strengthen your resolve to do hard things. Hard things.
Yeah.
I would want to be able to depend on that vow. That I could be there for my wife when she really needed me and she could do nothing for me. And that might take heroic charity on my part. The question of the validity of marriage, Christ said what God has joined together, man can't separate. Period, end of paragraph. A valid marriage is indissoluble until death, period. And one of the reasons... is precisely this, so that when the going gets tough, it gets those who are going to toughen up and to do the hard thing. I want to know that I could be there for my wife if she were in those circumstances, and that she could be there for me in like circumstances. You know, I was listening to a podcast the other day that was out of France, where I think something like 60% of children are born outside of marriage. And, you know, marriage rates have just plummeted to practically non-existence, and so cohabitation is the way to go. And it was a talk show where listeners call in and they ask their existential life problems of this philosopher who gives his opinion on how to handle it. In this particular case, this woman called in and she said, you know, my partner, quote unquote,
yeah,
has fallen ill and cannot work. And so I have to share my salary with him, you know, to keep him going. And quite honestly, it embitters me. And there are times that I just want to wash my hands of him and dump him because I feel resentful at basically being taken in this way, but he doesn't have any choice because he can't work because he's sick. And the philosopher said what he was going to say. And then I went home and I told my wife, I said, you know, that this is fascinating to me because I can't even contemplate being in that position.
Yeah.
You know, like you and I don't have different bank accounts. We don't have, you know, we don't have his and hers. Like we really, we're one flesh in every respect. Like
Team Anders.
Yeah, it's just one thing.
Sure.
You know, and it wouldn't cross my mind. I mean, I might feel grief stricken, but it wouldn't cross my mind to be resentful of my wife for being ill. Nor would she feel resentful of me for being ill. It'd just be, okay, this is just the cross I'm bearing, and it may be a heavy one, and I may hate it, and I may want God to take it away from me. But I'm never going to do otherwise, right? Now, I understand that that's tough. But to your point about the annulment, look, if the guy said, I absolutely refuse to abide by the church's teaching on marriage, I mean, at the end of the day, he could just go out and become a fornicator and just abandon, you know, his wife to her family, which is what they wanted, rather than offer. And, you know, I don't know all the details of the Schiavo case, and it's been 20 years, but I seem to remember that there were other motives than merely wanting to be free of the bonds of matrimony, right? And I'm not going to go into that. I don't want to be, well, I just, there were motives.
Sure.
All right.
Sure.
And, yeah, so that's what I have to say.
We might also refer you, Jim, in Portland, to the Terry Schiavo Life and Hope Network that was founded and is run by Bobby Schindler, her brother. And he appears every Friday on the Sunrise Morning Show here on EWTN Radio. Jim, thanks so much for your call. Call to Communion here on EWTN. This question, a little bit long. This is from David. How would you answer this question without taking into consideration the authority of the church? The closer we get to the time of the apostles, the easier it is to find writers supporting Old Testament canon lists that resemble a lot of the Protestant vision or version. Moreover, the only reason the church ended up using the deuterocanonical sections is that they were using the Septuagint for practical reasons. For example, those non-converted Jews who had access to the scriptures obviously wouldn't have let Christians, whom they considered heretics, view their texts to avoid further heretical developments. Sorry if the question is too long. Thanks for all that you do. David.
Yeah, so the closer you get to antiquity,
yeah,
the closer you get to mainstream Catholic writers taking the Arian point of view sometimes, or the Nestorian point of view sometimes, or the Manichaean point of view sometimes, or the Gnostic point of view sometimes. In other words, earlier in the church's history, there are theological issues that are not well defined, where you will find a spectrum of opinions from those that would tend much more closely to what we would consider orthodoxy today, to those that are tending more closely to positions that will ultimately be ruled heretical. The reason they all coexisted in the church, you know, to varying degrees and on a spectrum, is mm-hmm. because they had not risen to the critical level of divisiveness that would eventually elicit a magisterial response in the form of a council that would define the answer. Right?
Okay.
So you know, take a church, ancient church writer like Origen. Origen, 3rd century Christian writer, very influential theologian, really, beyond a shadow of a doubt, the most influential theologian before the 4th century. Continues to have a huge impact on Catholic life and thought right today. Held a lot of positions that are now regarded as heterodox. Most famously, the apokatastasis, the doctrine that the devils will be saved, which the church now teaches is heretical, but also a subordinist Christology that it wasn't Arian, but you know, the Arians read Origen and the Orthodox read Origen. They got different things out of him with respect to Christology, okay? Mm-hmm. And, I mean, you could kind of go on all day. There's a lot of things in Origen that were kind of iffy, right? Even though that doesn't keep him from having had a tremendous positive theological impact. So just because something is ancient doesn't by any stretch of the imagination mean that alone makes it authoritative. That premise, which I'll call primitivism, is an ideological position that emerges in the church in a big way, really in the Cluniac reform, and then in the papal reform, the Gregorian reform under Pope Hildebrand, who says we need to reform the church by going back to ancient canons. And that's 500 years before the Reformation. Mm. And then, of course, big time in the Protestant Reformation that explicitly embraces the idea of primitivism. Let's leapfrog back across centuries, get back to antiquity. Problem for the Protestants is that antiquity didn't at all conform to their vision of the church, so that it doesn't really work for them. And then, you know, the 19th century, you get radical restorationism in the form of, say, the Christian Church or the Mormon Church that say everything after the apostles was a wash, right? But that ideology of primitivism is not itself primitive. So, you know, if you read theologians of the 1st, 2nd, 3rd century, or you read the New Testament writers, they don't present Christian orthodoxy as a return to antiquity, nor do they present their own time as somehow the standard against which all future times have to be judged. Right? They have different criteria for understanding orthodoxy. And in particular, agreement with the Roman Church. So you take somebody like Irenaeus or even Tertullian, who ends up leaving the Catholic Church. Both of them understand that there is theological diversity in their own day. Right? So they don't point to the second century as the ideal time.
Yeah.
They recognize the second century is a mess. And they go, we have to find a way to cut through the fog and arrive at theological consensus. How are we going to do that? Oh, I know. Agree with the Roman Church. Not agree with some ill-defined alleged consensus of second-century writers.
Yeah.
So, yes, there are second- and third-century writers that have Old Testament canon lists that are more similar to Protestantism. Those are the ones to which Protestants appeal. And there are Old Testament canon lists that don't conform to the Protestant model. And you're wrong to suggest that the only reason people use the LXX was because, let's say, the Septuagint, was because it was convenient to do so. St. Augustine explicitly addresses this question in his book on Christian Doctrine, and he says, when quoting the Old Testament, when reading the Old Testament, do you use the Hebrew or do you use the Greek? And Augustine's position is you use the Greek not because it's colloquial,
mm-hmm.
but because it's the ecclesiastical version. It's the authorized translation. It's the one that the Catholic Church uses. So it's based on a theological criterion, not a pragmatic one.
Okay. Well, very good. And we just got a question from Miguel on YouTube, and there's just not enough time to give it justice, a proper answer, because by the time that I read the question, it'll be done. We just can't do it. So, Miguel, first of all, thanks for watching us on YouTube today. We're going to hold over your question, and it's a very good question, until tomorrow's program. So be sure to join us for that. And also want to thank David for that question that he sent in regarding, you know, the Protestant version. and all that. So thank you, and thank you, Dr. David
Thank
Anders.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you, Tom.
We do this program Monday through Friday right here on EWTN Radio. Do check it out Monday through Friday at 2 p.m. Eastern. You can also check out the podcast, not necessarily at 2 p.m. Eastern, any time of the day or night by going to EWTN.com, click on radio, and then once you're there, it's going to take you to the radio homepage. Then look for the words Podcast Central. On behalf of our fantastic team here, including Mr. Charles Beery, who handled all the social media for us today, I'm Tom Price, along with Dr. David Anders. Hey, thanks for joining us. We will see you at this time next time tomorrow, right here on EWTN's Call to Communion. Have a wonderful day. God bless.